Let us look at the man who disrupted the great consultation of the leaders of the world. In his heart are the teachings of Karl Marx. You students have heard, know about the kind of life he lived, how his wife suffered, how his children starved. Here's what one man who knew him says about him. Marx loved his own person much more than he loved his friends and apostles. And no friendship could hold water against the slightest wound to his vanity. Marx will never forgive a slight to his person. You must worship him, make an idol of him. If he is to love you in return, you must at least fear him if he is to tolerate you. He likes to surround himself with people.
This is our meeting on, what is it, the 7th? Is today the 7th?
Sure, yeah.
Today is November 7th, and this is our Solidarity Collective meeting. And yeah, go ahead, anytime.
Yeah, so I'm going to suggest that what we do as a community is quit recycling plastic. And the reason for this is that I've seen a number of articles that suggest that because there's no plastic recycling market in the U.S. anymore, and China's not accepting our plastic recycling as it used to, what happens to most of the plastic that people want to recycle is that after it gets put into the bin, it gets put on big freight ships that go to impoverished countries in Asia, Indonesia, for example. And then that plastic is either illegally disposed there or it's burned. It's not actually recycled. So we're spending money to alleviate our guilt by dumping our plastic on someone else, but we're not actually doing any constructive good.
Yeah.
So my suggestion is that the way that we approach the whole idea of plastic is to try to cut it down on the front end as much as possible. Just try to buy things in bulk, and where there are options to buy cans or glass instead of plastic, we get those types of containers. But I think that plastic recycling these days, as it stands, is a net loss for the environment. And I'd be willing to link all of you to several articles that make this argument. So
I'm looking at a bunch of those articles right now. I mean, I just Googled it, and it looks like what you're saying is a consensus, and that it's either dumped in landfills here or shipped overseas. Now, China was taking it for a while, and they stopped.
Thanks, Trump.
And so that's part of the reason why they stopped.
Yeah.
What were they doing with it, though? Were they legitimately recycling it?
Sometimes. Other times, people would take the plastic that came off the boat and say they were going to recycle it and sell it for shredding for other industrial purposes, or burn it or illegally dispose it. So China was having its own problems with...
Which is why they stopped accepting it.
One of the reasons why they stopped.
Yeah, not only problems.
But it was causing problems in China in the first place. So.
So I would love to look at some of the articles on this. I mean, my understanding is that it's spotty, that in some places your stuff is really going to recycling in the U.S. and in some places it's not, because there's still plenty of recycled plastic being produced somewhere. And so I wonder if there's a way to find out if
I think
the place
matters.
That we take it, what's happening there, because that's really what matters with it.
Right. I mean, I think it also matters probably what type of plastic it is. There are certain types that are more recyclable than others. And I don't know how that matches up against what our recycling center, you know, will take. They do commingled containers, which is a lot of different kinds of containers, which kind of makes me think maybe, like, not as much, unless they're sorting out the high dollar stuff and throwing away the rest, which is probably what's happening.
This article from 2017 says 91% of plastic is not recycled. And that's from National Geographic, which is a fairly credible source. And that was before, I guess that was before that. And the articles that are kind of at the top, which are from sources like The Guardian and The Atlantic, and so, you know, have some credibility, even if bourgeois credibility, they probably fact check. So yeah, I would absolutely encourage you to read the articles and judge. It certainly looks like, we're talking about maybe most of all the plastic. I would also say, in support of the proposal, that radically buying less plastic is as some of us would say, an independent net benefit.
That
is just good practice anyway.
My concern about that is going to be that it's going to impact. It's going to make our stuff potentially more expensive, because it might mean that we can't always buy like the cheapest thing or what have you. And you know, it's not that that's a deal breaker, but I think that that's going to probably require a pretty radical adjustment in how we eat and cook.
I don't think we need to totally stop buying plastic. I don't think we need to be absolutists about it. I think when there's a feasible alternative way to make the purchase rather than plastic, we ought to go for that. And when there's not a feasible alternative, we buy the plastic thing, we throw it away.
Right. Well, and this points, I mean, we're already talking about trying to like buy stuff in bulk as much as possible.
Yeah.
And so we're already headed in that direction.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I'm trying to think of what we get in plastic. I mean, yogurt is probably one of the big things.
Right.
And then a lot of dumpstered stuff, which like
we're getting it from the dumpster now, though.
Right.
So at that point, it's like, well, it was going to be thrown away anyway. Right. So ethically, who cares if we eat the food before it comes to the landfill?
We're just removing the food and bringing it home in the container it was in. Yeah, so it might be interesting to actually look at, like, where are we still bringing a lot of plastic into the house and, you know, try to cut down on it as best. I mean, the plastic film was not recyclable anyway, and that's...
The plastic film.
Like the...
Plastic wrap.
The olives that we just bought, that case of olives is wrapped in plastic.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And that film was not going to be recyclable anyway. Yeah. Right, so...
Yeah. I mean, the only thing not recyclable in that hole, that's the only thing not recyclable in that hole. The cans are easily recyclable. Yeah.
Right. So it's in a little cardboard thing.
Cardboard,
and we're reusing the cardboard if it's
not
super glossy in the garden at this point.
Right.
Okay. The gardening program. So, yeah.
Okay.
So, so I want to make a call and just find out if we can find out any information about, like, what's happening from our actual recycling center. Maybe that will be untraceable. Maybe I will feel like I'm just getting bullshit, but I think that would be good. And I would love to read some of the articles, but
I can paste and forward you. Everything I read from Counterpunch, I don't go into the mainstream media sources, but I obviously trust the authors of Counterpunch or I wouldn't be reading it. So.
Right. Great. So,
trust The Guardian, as you know, as mainstream UK publications go. It's left side of the spectrum, and it's it seems to be a pretty well fact checked newspaper.
Uh-huh.
So,
okay.
Probably
one of the biggest sources of plastic that we're bringing into the house right now is in fast food cups, actually. So,
yeah,
that
and,
would be
and
near
the,
really
and
good.
Like the.
The zero
bottles,
calorie
yeah.
drinky things.
Oh, yeah,
like
yeah, yeah.
Individually portioned drinks, which I was actually looking at as a double. Like, maybe we should consider if that's something that people really, like, enjoy, we could get, like, a soda stream or some business like that and make our own carbonated beverages of whatever flavors we want.
All of my New York City friends have those things in their apartments. It's weird.
Yeah. They'd make like...
I would totally be for that. Like,
yeah.
You know, because then we would be able to design... We'd make Solidarity Soda.
Right.
Solidarity Soda!
Solipop.
Solipop.
Solipop. Solipop.
Shouldn't have started it.
Yeah, I know.
Oh,
it's all your fucking fault.
Should have heard what we were singing today out in the garden. No, shouldn't have.
Right.
Okay, cool. So, Soda Stream. Somebody wants to buy us a Soda Stream for Christmas.
Well,
she has two.
She has two. Oh.
So I was going to see if she wanted to, like, just give me the extra one. We've been trading stuff.
Cool.
Pretty consistently, so I don't feel bad taking it from her,
because
I just gave her our rice cooker like 10 days ago.
Cool. Well, that probably is a good idea anyway. What was it, the debate term you used a minute ago?
An independent net benefit.
Independent net benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I supposedly make a pretty nasty root beer syrup.
Sounds good.
Yeah. We have root beer extract.
Cool. Okay, great. So... we're going to look at articles. I'm going to call Fort Collins, and we're going to come back to this, but it sounds like we're headed in the direction of maybe adopting this proposal.
Thank you, J. Scott Rodriguez.
I do what I can.
Fort Collins Recycling. Cool. Alrighty. Greenhouse update?
Shit.
Yeah, so Styles and I did the complicated part. Thank you, Styles.
Yeah.
And we got the panels. Thank you, everybody who showed up yesterday for that. Yay. So a couple of things. One is I'm definitely going to need some help with the installation. So I don't know if somebody wants to be my buddy for that and, like, actually... figure out a time for us to do that, or if we want to just kind of, you want to be my buddy? Mr. Standard, will you be my buddy? Okay, cool. Nice.
It's always good to have the help of the hill giant.
I know, right? Right, for like the tall shit.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I need to do another round of shopping at the hardware store, and then we should be able to do that. And Archer has already said that he will help me with the door. I don't appear to be very good at like the hardware for doors and getting it actually so it works as a door and staying closed and shit. And Archer is going to help me with that part, which is the last part that feels technically more complicated. The other part that we need to figure out is, so the wood that's out there that's going to be exposed needs to get either like stained or painted. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a decision to make. And then there's also next to both of the doors that have already been hung and framed, there's a panel that's about like 8 or 9 inches wide, and I could just cover it with wood and insulate it, or we could finish those in some other way that's like aesthetically pleasing or fancy or something. So taking ideas for that.
How about we talk to Jason?
Oh,
and see if he would like to get involved in that part of the that part of the project. I think he might be eager to do that.
Cool. Okay, so does somebody want to reach out to Jason and ask him about that?
I mean, you know, you just described what was going on. So if you would either write that description down for me or call him yourself, I'll do it.
Okay. The spots, okay. And then you can just show Jason the spots.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, cool. Cool, and then there was one. Oh, and Archer, I think that I had told you this, but I'm not sure. There's two electrical things that need to get moved before I can finish it off. Did I tell you that already, or has that gotten lost in the shuffle?
I knew about the one box that was over against the dining room.
Okay. The other one is the light next to the entry into the annex kitchen.
Okay.
Is like right smack dab in the middle of where we need to attach the greenhouse to the house. And so I think it can just be like taken off and capped off.
Okay. I'll pick up a plate at the hardware store and pull it down.
Great.
The next couple of days.
Okay. Great. And just like as you... get well. I just don't want to rush you and your getting wellness.
Yeah, no, we'll see how I feel, but I don't think that's not going to take a lot of time.
Okay.
Or a lot of energy.
I want to rush you and your getting wellness.
All right. Anything else greenhouse related? Cool.
Check. You are running for U.S. Senate, and it's not something that we really overcover on our podcasts because, it's kind of weird. I know that at the beginning of your campaign, you had written an op-ed that we ran on Cowboys on the Commons blog about being a not rich person running for office.
Mm-hmm.
And so this week, your only opponent right now, the Republican, or maybe
your main opponent. Yeah, the front runner
in the race
is Cynthia Lummis.
Cynthia Lummis. Mm-hmm. published, I guess, her financial profile. Is that what it
was?
Well,
it was just, it was on Ballotopedia, and I just noticed, I had looked at her profile when I first was thinking about running, and just noticed that her net worth has changed, has gone up by like $2 million, I think, since the last time I saw it. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. And just wondered if people realize that she's actually a multimillionaire. And so I had made a kind of snarky remark about it on my Facebook page, and then realized that people might be wondering about what my net worth is. Mm-hmm.
So what is Cynthia Lummis's net worth?
It's ballpark? Like 14 million and change, which is probably far more. Her change is a lot more than my net worth.
Which seems to be, to me, nobody needs that much money.
Right. Right. I mean, like, I could see productively spending $100,000 a year, and beyond that, I just, my mind goes a little wonky trying to figure out how people actually spend that much money.
And so this is, I mean, it exposes, I think, a big, obviously a big class issue, a big socioeconomic class issue in terms of running for office, and particularly running for national offices. And that, and this is, and actually this reminds me of, you know, there's another acquaintance of ours who is an entrepreneur, and who refused to donate to your campaign, even though they could have, they had the means to do it. And they, their rationale was basically that you were not rich enough to be running a race.
Right, that they can't imagine me winning without raising $1 million. And I'm obviously not someone who's going to be able to raise $1 million. So I'm not going to donate to your campaign, which was like, way to contribute to a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I mean, that's just such a raw manifestation of the very classism that we're talking about. And that, you know, so that for some people, they're like, well, let's just be realistic about this. You know, you shouldn't be running at all.
Right, right. Well, and I think there's also a piece about like, well, if I don't think you can win, then I also don't think there's any reason for a campaign to even be happening, which, I mean, if you look at like the Sanders campaign in 2016, like that was like culture changing in some really significant ways, having somebody like full on run, even though, you know, he didn't end up winning. And so there's part of me that's like, I think particularly in a place like Wyoming, which, you know, is typically fairly far to the right and doesn't question that self-identity as a state. Like, I think it's really worth having.
I mean, as somebody who's run, as somebody who's been doing, you know, radical politics for almost 30 years, there are hundreds of reasons to run for office besides just winning. And the number one reason is to build a movement, which isn't going to happen if you don't run, and if poor people don't run, then that's precisely, I mean, so that's what's, you know, that I think is kind of what blew me away about this person's kind of response about it was, is like, you are saying that poor people shouldn't run for national office. I mean, you're basically, that is, you know, that's your position. Time out here while I make sure that it's still recording.
Yep. There we are. It's still going.
Yep. So anyway, that which brings us to this issue of you, you know, then that spending this time to create, to calculate your net worth.
Yeah.
And kind of what that has been all about. And, you know, obviously, you know, I'm not looking for an answer to what your net worth is. I'm just wondering if you want to talk a little bit about that experience, about going through that, going down that net worth rabbit hole.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because in some ways I am somebody who, I am not without privilege financially, for sure. And, you know, and so it's a, you know, it's a little bit complicated, and there's, you know, like I have definitely referred to myself as economically insecure and as poor and, you know, various other things along those lines. And actually, like, drilling down into the numbers and looking at like where's the discrepancy between what things sound like on paper. Like technically I'm a co-owner of two different houses because I've had a house that I own with my ex-husband that's been on the market for 4 years. And then I'm the co-owner, you know, with a group here of the house in Wyoming. And so it's like, you know, somebody could easily like pull out the like, oh, she owns two houses thing. But it's like, the reality is like, when I get done putting all these numbers into this spreadsheet, my net worth is probably negative mm-hmm. when it comes down to it. And, you know, and feeling a certain amount of like a lot of feelings coming up, but there's definitely a certain amount of like shame around that, that I think, you know, I'm almost 50 years old. I should have it figured out financially. And that's the story that capitalism gives all of us, that like, you know, if you sort of play the game properly, like by the time you're of a certain age, you'll be financially secure and abundant and all that kind of stuff. And it's just bullshit. And we know it's bullshit. And actually doing that, drilling into my own numbers, has brought up a whole big chunk of that kind of, like, I feel insecure looking at these numbers in a way that I feel like living in community and having like strong family support and that kind of stuff often protects me from those feelings, but actually like laying it out in such bald terms in a spreadsheet has definitely brought up a bunch of those feelings for me. And, you know, and not just shame, but a certain amount of anxiety as well when you actually look at it really baldly. And, you know, and just realizing like my main opponent can just throw some of her own money into her campaign and have staff and all that kind of stuff. And that like, I don't have the ability to do that. And that there's a way that like you don't necessarily think all the way about that when you're thinking about candidates and like who has access to like easy support and easy money and who has a social network of people who have money. And just being like really in touch this week with this and some other things that I've been doing campaign related, with like how much that's not my reality and that we're just sort of like scraping by and pulling this together as best we can. And that's the experience of working class and poor people all over this country for whatever their daily lives look like. And I'm just trying to do this thing that's putting me into the spotlight a little bit with it, but it's like, this is just the reality that most people deal with on a daily basis.
So it seems to me that having $14 million or having, more money than you will ever need. Mm-hmm. And this sort of knowing that you will never want for anything, mm-hmm. knowing that if the bottom falls out from under you on one front, that you always have backup, mm-hmm. that you will always have backup, that you will always right. have fallback and plenty of fallback. Is one reason why, to me, having that much money should disqualify you from yeah. public office
Absolutely.
Rather than qualify you for it, because you are not thinking like the average person, which is not to say that you need to be thinking like the average person in every way, but that you don't understand. And it's like
there's a fundamental disconnect there between like you and the majority of people that you're supposed to be representing.
Right. And so that, I mean, and that's, I guess that's number one. The other thing though, is the way that it affects your interests, mm-hmm. And the choices that you're going to make, mm-hmm. because if you have to exercise leadership on economic questions, well, economic questions and the consequences of economic policy fall differently on different people, right. different classes of right. people. And so you stand to benefit and your class stands to benefit and your loved ones stand to benefit from the policies that tend to prop up great wealth if you are of that class. Mm-hmm. And so even if you are not committing a technical conflict of interest in terms of making those decisions, there is a baked-in conflict of interest in terms of what benefits you versus what benefits everybody else, because we know that trickle-down economics is a myth. Mm-hmm. No serious person is defending trickle-down economics anymore. And so we know that, you know, people benefit differently, and that a small, tiny, tiny minority benefits from certain economic policies that hurt everybody else. And so, to me, there's a baked-in conflict of interest in having that much money mm-hmm. and running for public office.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, and it's also interesting that what got me looking at Ballotopedia again was wondering what Cynthia Lummis has on her website, and I went and, you know, did like a screenshot of her incredibly short bullet point platform. I guess it's not really even a platform, it's really just some bullet points, but one of them is, you know, fighting against the socialist agenda. And, you know, and there's definitely people that I see on social media that are like, you know, yeah, we don't want your socialism here and that kind of stuff. And yet it's like the only people that should be afraid of socialism are people like Cynthia Lummis, because they are the ones who are at risk of having their lives change for the worse, where everybody else is potentially going to have their lives change for the better by being under that system. And, you know, so it was, that was the, having that line on her website was sort of what ticked me off to the point that I'm like, fine, I'm going to like make a snarky comment about your like net worth, because it's like so clear why you're against socialism and why you're against having more worker power and more power for people in the working class and poor people. Because, yep, you actually should be afraid of this happening, but most of the people voting for you shouldn't be afraid of it.
There's this, you know, this saying and about temporarily embarrassed millionaires,
right,
and how
right.
most people think, or at least a lot of people think. I mean, if you look at public opinion and the way that it's shifting, and particularly with people under 40,
mm-hmm.
you see that there's a lot of consciousness shift going on.
Right.
But nevertheless, you know, the typical poor or working class person that is going to be voting for Cynthia Lummis in this
mm-hmm.
election feels like they're better. Feels like Cynthia Lummis is better.
Mm-hmm.
than someone who doesn't have $14 million.
Right, right. Yep, and I think that that's a lot of the messaging that we get from capitalism, is that how much money you have is somehow a measure of, I mean, it's not only your worth in a really literal way, but it's also sort of your moral fiber in some way, and your goodness as a person shows up in how much money you have. And I think most of us know that that's BS, but I think it also, you know, does some really weird stuff to our brains and has us like buy into things that are actually fundamentally really bad for us, because there's that hope that, you know, well, my ship is going to come in at some point if I just continue working hard and being whatever my definition of a good person is, because that's the messaging that we get. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that it does play into how people vote, because they look at the bottom line with hers, which is a huge positive number, and with mine, which is going to be a negative number, and that says something about me in a lot of people's eyes. And, you know, it's hard to be filling out this spreadsheet and knowing that in the back of my head as well.
We were we went to the phone store today, we were watching this House Hunters reality
House
TV
Hunters
show.
House Hunters International.
I mean, these were, you know, the people that were on the show seemed like nice kind of people, genuine, real people, except that they had been given this framework and that they clearly bought into this framework where happiness was, you know, had this number attached to it.
Right.
And that happiness, you know, meant having sort of the good life in a certain way. And like, I don't think that socialists say, I know that socialists don't say that the enjoyment of life is wicked
mm-hmm.
in some way, or that we should not enjoy life, or even that we should not have material things and have enjoyable material
right,
things.
But we don't conflate like having material goods with being good people, or even with happiness. Like, I think that's, that conflation gets unplugged, at least to some extent,
or
that really bought into socialism.
Or that insofar as material stuff is necessary for happiness
mm-hmm.
and for having a secure life or having
right.
a comfortable life, that's fine, provided that everyone has access to the things that they need.
Right.
And also, we would also, of course, add the you know, the sort of green element of that, you know, that we need to make sure that we have comfortable lifestyles that are also sustainable, you know, environmentally sustainable right. lifestyles and,
right.
And those kinds of things. And I mean, it's just no coincidence to me that that a candidate who is a multimillionaire is also, you know, not just dismissive of sustainability, of environmental sustainability, mm-hmm. but is fucking contemptuous
right.
of environmental right. sustainability. Like that it's evil, mm-hmm. that wanting to that wanting to create a sustainable economy and a sustainable environmental policy and all of those things is part of this nefarious socialist plot that has to be fought against.
Right. And it's not understanding security on two levels. I mean, one of it is like what people's actual economic security needs are, and also that having a planet is a fundamental part of that security. You know, that there's a blowing off of what security means for your average person. And this, and I guess there must be a belief in there somewhere that like, if you have enough money, you can buy yourself out of or buy your way out of ecological disasters as well.
Which, you know, is
because you're used to being able to buy your way out of just about anything.
Well, that was the gist also of the conversation that Naomi Klein had with the folks on Chapo Trap House right. in that recent episode, mm-hmm. Where they interviewed Naomi again, that for the second time on their show. But this time they were talking about this notion that the elites have kind of accepted the fact that all sorts of terrible things are going to happen
to everybody else.
And that we need fascism. What we need is fascism as a way
right.
of dealing with those inequities and those crises and those disasters, so that rather than dealing with those crises in a more democratic way, the only way to deal with them is in a less democratic way, because that's the only way that's going to preserve the hierarchies and autocracies and the fiefdoms that
right.
that the wealthy are going to build for themselves. And so, of course, a candidate like that is going to lead with build the wall,
right.
because the wall keeps out you know, the people that you know, that cannot build those fortresses themselves.
Right, right. And so much of what's happening at our border right now is actually related to climate disruption mm-hmm. and people leaving their homes because they can no longer feed themselves. Like, this is really, really fundamental stuff. And it's that stuff that I feel like having that much money sort of creates this barrier between you and the ability to actually understand and have empathy for, and certainly to act on behalf of, based on other people. And I don't think it's because they don't understand it. I think they get it. I just think that they're used to being able to protect themselves and they don't have to care.
How do you respond to kind of going through this personal experience of seeing how, you know, kind of how relatively deprived materially you are, you know, in comparison to the front runner in the campaign? Does that light a fire or does that make it harder? What happens?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, I think, yes, it does make it harder. I mean, it feels like a bigger barrier to get where we need to get in terms of having what we need for the campaign. So I think there is a little bit of that. But I mean, mostly it just like feeds that fire for me. I mean, this is why I'm running. It's about economic insecurity at a really fundamental level. It's about this ecological stuff that I think most rich people are continuing to blow off again because they don't feel like they need to care about this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I think mostly it like lights a little more fire under my butt for like, yes, there is a reason why I'm doing this. And there is a reason why it's really important that people like me are actually getting in there and being part of the electoral scene. And, you know, there was an interesting, you know, AOC has been getting more publicity again recently because of her recent endorsement of Bernie Sanders. And there was just this article that came out where she's basically saying like, yeah, if we really want to get somewhere with all of these different issues that we care about, we need to fundamentally change who is in the conversations in DC. Basically, we need a bigger squad. And so I'm committed to trying to be one of those people and trying to get in there and being part of those conversations. And I do think that this process has sort of reinforced all of the reasons why I'm running.
Maybe we're in an era of anti-stewardship, as we can see in newspapers, say the Denver Post, for instance. It, you know, when that was taken over a few years ago, I mean, they have gutted that newspaper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
First, the pension fund was sucked away, and that newspaper is now a very poor example of good newspaper.
Well, the news media as a whole, not just the newspaper business being a prime example, but the whole news media thing, from television all the way to radio to everything, there is no investment into improving the quality or quantity of news. It's more, what can we pull off the wire and regurgitate? Because that doesn't cost us any money.
Can I just ask a question about what we're talking about? I've heard the terms anti-capitalist and non-capitalist be introduced. And I'm not sure, are those the same thing? Are they different? Let me just spiel on this for a moment. To me, a non-capitalist is someone who is looking to disengage as much as possible from the capitalist economy. So you're trying to do sustainability things on the ground. You're being a non-capitalist. You're disengaging. You're getting out. But if you're being an anti-capitalist, the way I'm thinking of the word, you're actively trying to bring down the system.
Right.
You're a militant instead of a pacifist.
You're an English major.
Well, I did get my undergrad degree in literature and creative writing. That's a good point. The terminology, I think, seems to be important because there are two huge processes that we're talking about, and they're also totally different from one another, or at least can be co-joined, but are, I mean, obviously they're not mutually exclusive, but you don't have to do both. So where are we as Solidarity House, non-capitalist, anti-capitalist, both, and how far can we go on the path of either of those directions? Because this, to some degree, is a conversation about what we're about, right?
It's interesting to me because we are, at least the origin of the creation of the community and the folks who got together and wanting to create the community, where some of them came from a sort, the sort of militant labor, militant socialist kind of background, and others came from the intentional communities movement background. Which is very much a, we are planting our seeds somewhere else, but we're not necessarily going to throw Molotov cocktails. and so I think that is such a good question, because those two ways of thinking are sometimes manifest as being in conflict with one another too. You have, you know, a lot of the militants are like, you can't just move to, you know, you can't just get a tract of land and move to the woods. And the sort of rebuilders, or whatever you want to call it, you know, whatever those are. You can't just sell out completely to the system. You need to develop new lifestyles and cultures. What were you going
to
say?
It seems to be a very common thing, especially actually in wetter climates like New England, for example. I know people who have gone and lived out in the woods, but invariably at some point, they actually become very good capitalists.
Right. Or have been a good capitalist so that they can do that, right? Yeah. Like to go and, you know what I mean? In order to opt out of capitalism, it requires a certain amount of capital.
I think you're also saying too that they become entrepreneurial when people are and I think that, you know, a lot of communities have good, but I don't think that that's necessarily bad as long as you have those.
Well, I also don't think it's inevitable. I mean, I know many people who have spent who are now gone have spent their entire lives in community and never really went back into the full on capitalist thing. So I don't think it's as inevitable as you're saying, but I do know examples of that. And I definitely know like some of the most like staunchly entrepreneurial people I know have lived in community for a long time. So I think that that does happen.
Yeah.
You know, I have a cousin in New Hampshire who used to live in communities of various types. And then he acquired his own land, about 20 acres or so. And right now he's an entrepreneur of yurts. And he got in on the ground floor when yurts were expanding.
Cool.
Different family members tend to hint that he is now a millionaire. Mm. He doesn't look it when you see him. But.
Well, I like yurts.
Yeah.
Yurts are great.
What would a billionaire yurt look like?
Oh, you can find him online.
12 stories high.
And then there's a friend of mine who travels from intentional community to intentional community building yurts from like whatever materials are easily available. And so I would say that he is the sort of non-capitalist and I think maybe even anti-capitalist version of your cousin who's like done it as like who has commodified traditional technology to get wealthy, which is the difference between that. Like yurts are not inherently bad, but you know, I'm not sure commodifying traditional technology to get rich is a good thing.
Well, and this is also where I'm probably going to stand in conflict with a few people, but I think it's possible to be financially successful and still be non-capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm. Like it's like I'm non-capitalist. I've always have been, more or less. But yet, I have a career path, or have had a career path, that has rewarded me reasonably well.
Well, so what does that mean
wage
to
labor.
Say that you're...
Well, exactly. It is to some extent wage labor. But
I think that's like the discussion, though. What do we mean when we say non-capitalist? Is it just sort of a like, orientation, my idealism, or kind of my like, what, you know, or is it a specific set of actions that involve, you know, opting out of capitalism in some way?
So as far as I know, nobody in this room is a capitalist. And even if you believed in capitalism, that's not what makes you a capitalist. A capitalist owns means of producing value and producing surplus value and employs and therefore exploits the wage labor or other type of paid work of others. To get more back than they invest in. That is the objective definition of a capitalist. That's why you're not a capitalist if you are a highly paid wage worker. An NFL football star is a member of the working class in that very broad definition of what the difference between capitalists and non-capitalists are.
The owners are making more.
So that's an interesting point, though, because, like, so let's talk about, like, an NFL player, right, that makes, like, a shitload of money, right, like a few million a year or more than that even, like, right, and they have, like, a super fancy house, and then so they start to accumulate, like, a staff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, at what point do you then become, like, even though you're, technically, it was like wage labor that got you, even, you know, someone who is in like Archer's line of work, right? Like, or in like Silicon Valley and makes like several hundred thousand a year and hire and has like staff or has like, you know what I mean? Like, at what point do you become micro capitalist?
So there are managers.
And you, do you know what I mean? If you own property and you have staff, like, does that not make you like sort of a micro capitalist?
You are a cap under this. under the strict definition, you are a capitalist if you derive surplus value from the labor of others or from natural resources or financial resources. If you derive surplus value from those things.
So it's not everyone who has, has like their retirement in like stocks and pension funds, then like a micro-capitalist?
Yes. Yeah, I mean,
you have a housekeeper who you don't pay the same amount that you make per hour for working in your house per hour, you're crossing that line.
Because you're exploiting that person's work to free up time for you to work more or for you to have leisure
in order to make more
and
money.
So you derive some kind of surplus value from that.
Millionaires should be required to pay their housekeepers like, what is it, like $400 an hour or something? I think that would be like just capital distribution.
Are so short that they melt in the air. Who could care? Who could care? And my cats, they mean everything to me. I understand them, I see their souls. But if I died today, then those souls would too. Who could care? Who could care? Don't get me wrong, I'm in awe. This world and its complexities. The meaning isn't based on the importance of being, but on the relationships in between.
The songs at the beginning and end of this episode come from the generosity of Hustlonia, a music collective that has made these tracks open to both commercial and non-commercial use. Our friends Tom, Byrne, Sean, and John joined us for the Solidarity Brunch, and our subscribers will soon get to hear that entire hour-plus-long discussion on capitalism and anti-capitalism. Become a subscriber today at patreon.com/solidarityhouse and help support not only our podcasts, including interviews with people all over who are changing the world, but also our building of the commune, our free collaborative art and activist space, and the promotion of communal ideals here in the land of carbon and cattle capitalism. Finally, thank you to everyone who's donated to our greenhouse project. We've started to build the thing. Come and visit and you can see for yourself. We're Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.